Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That's Matthias's Sir Christmas, and that was the Choral Arts Society, and it is one of the pieces that they are going to be performing this weekend as they present their much-loved Lessons and Carols concert in two performances, Friday night in Waterford, Sunday afternoon in Racine. And James Schatzman is going to be on the podium leading them through that joyous occasion. Jim Schatzman is here with us on the morning show today, not only to talk about the Lessons and Carols and the Choral Arts Society return to live performance in front of live audiences, but also to talk about an interview that aired last week on WGTD's morning show, which concerns his professional pursuit during the day as director of Racine Vocational Ministries, which works with the recently incarcerated and helps them to find their way back into the workforce. And I interviewed the author of a book called Untapped Talent, which talked about that very thing, and I was very anxious right from the start to have Jim Schatzman come on the program to talk about this topic through kind of a local lens. So that's what we're going to be doing a little bit later in the hour. Jim Schatzman, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Good to be here.
And good to have you here in the studios. I'm just glad that we can have this conversation. So let's talk, first of all, a little bit about what the Choral Arts Society did during the height of the COVID pandemic. And of course, the pandemic by no means is over. You know, we've entered yet another kind of concerning phase of it. But of course, we're not where we were a year ago, pre-vaccine, when things were so scary, right, and so much had come to a standstill, including nearly all of the performing arts. Mm-hmm. So what was the Choral Arts Society doing during that period, beginning with that spring concert that had to be abruptly canceled at the very last minute?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't done a program since Lessons and Carols in 2019. And so we've been kind of shuttered for quite some time. We haven't rehearsed since, as you said, since early March of 2020, which for any performing arts organization is a real challenge. I mean, Part of you know, community singing is, you know, keeping people in shape and helping them to kind of reach beyond their average, you know, their average commitments during the week. And so for 2 years, basically 2 years, most of us have been home, sheltering at home and being careful. And so really the focus of the organization was on survival. I mean, we moved into a very aggressive fundraising area, which I have to say that the community's generosity has just been stunning. I mean, absolutely stunning. We're in very good financial position where in February, March of 2020, we were wondering, you know, if we were going to have to lay off staff, if we were going to have to just kind of close up for a while and hope our staff would hang around and come back,
right,
you know, after the issue. And none of that had to be done. Part of that's due to the federal support that went out early on. We were the recipients of one of the earliest interventions, which was the Payroll Protection Program. Mm. And so our staff was paid to continue working through this federal grant for several months. And then we received a second payroll protection, which gave us another couple of months. And now we're, you know, 70% of the way through kind of the pandemic era where we're not even really doing any serious planning. We also have other grants in the offing, and we're probably in the strongest financial position we've been in years. But it's weird to be in that position and not really be mission centered. I mean, our mission is to, you know, create programs and to offer opportunities for, you know, for community members to sing at a high level, and all of that was on hold. I mean, it was strange, to say the least.
To be devoting your energies to raising money and keeping the lights on versus doing what you want to do. I know that there were periodic projects to keep the Choral Arts Society visible in the community. Just remind our listeners about that.
Sure. Really, thanks very much to some of our to our staff, but also to a really committed volunteer in the chorus who started off, Karel Suki, who actually was able to take some of our recordings and video material and create digital programs. And so the commitment was that from the time we closed down, every concert cycle that when we would normally be performing, we were presenting archived music and sometimes archived video as well, wherever we could locate it, to keep ourselves in front of the audience and actually to help even the chorus keep some energy. Julia, Suki, our manager, did a terrific job of making sure that those were marketed not only to the public but to our membership, so they could still feel like something was going on. Right. They could hear something they sang in. And remind them that you know, music is important and it's part of not just of what we do, but who we are. Hmm. And so keeping that connection was really important.
So what was it like to finally sort of inch towards the possibility of actually performing live in front of a live audience again? First of all, at what point in time was that decision made and how tricky was it to make that decision?
Well, I can tell you that it was not made without a certain amount of angst. You know, we've been following kind of direction from Chorus America, which is our oversight organization. Mm. They've been publishing just mountains of material on, you know, the risks of singing and aerosols and how that's heightened from just speaking, the kind of ways you have to shape a rehearsal, you know, and we've been watching in the industry who is ready to put their toe in the water. And we found that as we began to cross closer to the new year here, more choruses were beginning to find ways to do live performing as this year, kind of concert year, started. And so, you know, will you wear a mask? Will you not wear a mask? Will you rehearse more than a half hour in any given space before you have to let it, you know, the makeup air system clear it out? All those kind of considerations were deliberated by the board, and at the point where we kind of felt, you know, a lot of our industry is beginning to move back. There may be adjustments or accommodations, but we're beginning to move back towards live performance. And so I think we kind of rode that wave in and decided that we would rehearse with masks, we would sing distanced, we would perform distanced. We would ask our audience to wear masks, and that they, when they come, they will they can sit with their families. But if they're, you know, to non-family, if there would be distance in the seating, and so we put some things in place to kind of create a situation where you can go and feel safe, which is important. It's hard to enjoy a program if you're worried about, you know, catching something. And I can say that now we've been rehearsing since October, we've not had one incident, not one, which has been very exciting. I cross my fingers. I almost hate to say that out loud. I don't want to jinx anything, but we've done very, very well by making sure that we create a safest environment as possible. Mm. And part of the other side of that question is, I mean, you know, we just saw people, you know, openly weeping when we started singing again. I mean, they hadn't had a chance to do this forever, and they realized how much they missed it. Mm.
You mean members of the chorus?
I do.
You had your first
rehearsal. Not me. Yeah. Members of the chorus.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that's so good to hear. I always like to tell people, and it's absolutely true, that, for instance, the Carthage Choir last year rehearsed all year long in person, but within very, very strict protocols, and in that whole school year, one student came down with COVID, and that one student didn't spread it to anybody else. Mm-hmm. And so it was pretty clear he happened to live off campus, and so it's almost certain that it was somewhere out there in the world that he caught it. And he was carefully sequestered from four roommates who were also members of the choir who quarantined and so on. But it was that just the one student who came down with it, and otherwise everyone was okay. And it just kind of underscored the fact that you have to be supremely careful, but when you are, it's even possible to sing and be safe, or at least sing and with risk minimized as much as possible. So you have dipped your toe in as well, and so you began rehearsing in October. So tell us what those rehearsals have been like and how they are different from rehearsals from, for instance, 2 years ago. Well, what kind of protocols have been in place?
One of the main protocols certainly is that is masking and distancing. But the other piece that Chorus America referenced to really strengthen things was that you didn't rehearse in any space more than a half hour before you gave 15 minutes to clear out. And I'm kind of a slave driver. I'm used to, I work very, very hard. I work very fast. And we cram a lot into a 50 or 60 minute opportunity to rehearse before we break. And so that changed dramatically. And the first couple of rehearsals, I was just supremely aware of how this cut into our efficiency. So at a half hour, we just simply stopped. And initially, we said that every half hour, we'll just take a 15-minute break. And that 15 minutes was the recommendation for makeup air to kind of clean out the aerosols. And, you know, 45 minutes a break in a rehearsal was just killing us. It was just, it was very hard to imagine being ready for a concert. And so we began to use one of the adjoining rooms. We would leave one room and go to another room and then go back and forth. And that kind of increased our efficiency. And so that really made a difference. And, you know, as a singer, you know, I mean, you put a mask on your face. If I were to put a mask on my face now, you would hear the immediate sibilance difference in the mic. It just eats consonants. It changes the overtones in the way that they respond in the room. It's not quite like singing in a pillow, but, you know, only slightly better. And so, you know, the strength of the chorus felt like it was just yanked right out. And, of course, added to that, we only had a little over 50% of the chorus opted to come back. And so it's just like the political, it's very surprising to me that that's how it laid out. And so we're up to more like 60% of the chorus being back now. And I think we'll be a little stronger after the new year. And so that changed it. The fact that just the chorus sounded so different, just the way that that sound hit me. And that took some adjusting, too. But I think we're in a zone now where we sound great. We're comfortable singing with masks on. The sound is shockingly good. We had a wonderful dress rehearsal yesterday.
Very
wonderful.
Good. Yeah. I suppose it feels good to be re-entering live performance with something that has been such a staple of the choral arts seasons for such a long time. How many of these lessons and carols have you done over the years?
Oh my gosh, I think this is the 20th year.
Wow.
That we've done them. And so a long time with only, you know, occasional interruptions. And so, you know, the other side of that too was that, you know, I think I mentioned before the program, the people were in dreadful vocal shape when they came back. I mean, they hadn't sung for a while. And then you put those other inhibitors in the way. I was very concerned the first couple of weeks. First 2 weeks were, I mean, I was just shocked by the sound. But sure. They just have gotten stronger and stronger and stronger. It's really been fun and a joy to hear.
Did you choose the repertoire with any of these limitations in mind?
Yes. Lessons and Carols is definitely our, I sometimes call it our recovery program. We usually do a big blockbuster or something fairly aggressive and new at the beginning of the year. And so that wasn't done. And the Lessons and Carols programs over the 20 years we kind of have a core of repertoire that we build from. And so there was a familiarity to a lot of the pieces that we've done for some of the chorus members as well. So that really aided us, I think, in kind of relieving anxiety, giving us some comfort level with what we were coming back to. The next concert will be more of a challenge, and we'll see where that goes. We'll be pressing them a little harder.
There you go. We're speaking with Jim Schatzman, who is director of the Choral Arts Society, and they are back in live performance this weekend, Friday night at St. Thomas Church in Waterford, Sunday afternoon at First Presbyterian in downtown Racine with their lessons and carols. And you brought with you a past compact disc of the Choral Arts, and what we heard at the outset was Sir Christmas by Matthias, which is one of the things that will be on this year's yes. Lessons and Carols. And I think there's something else from this disc as well.
Yes. I think one of my favorite pieces, you know, that was written by Paul Mons in a moment of distress as his son was in a very difficult situation in the hospital. And this text, as I understand it, came to his wife, In So, Lord Jesus, Quickly Come. And he framed out this piece in his head in an emergency room, waiting for his son to kind of pull through, which he did. That was many years ago. I believe his son has been a bishop in Minnesota, and so has definitely led a full life and recovered from that that issue. So, In So, Lord Jesus Christ, from by Paul Mons.
And here it is off of this CD from a few years back by the Choralite Society. Paul Mann says, "In so, Lord Jesus, quickly come." This is one of the pieces that will be sung by the Choral Arts Society for their performances this week of their lessons and carols. Again, Friday night, 7 o'clock at St. Thomas Church in Waterford. Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock at First Presbyterian Church in Racine. And people can purchase tickets, I assume, via your website or at the
Absolutely.
Door as well?
And on the website, they can also be purchased at the door.
Okay.
$15 in advance and $17 at the door.
And you will be required to wear a mask, and physical distancing is going to be requested of the audience to keep everybody as safe as possible in order to enjoy what promises to be a really beautiful program. Anything else real quick you want to mention in terms of repertoire?
No, I just say come and enjoy the program. It's great to be performing live again. And I think the star of the show is live performance this year. And we are in front of people.
Right. It's nothing any of us will take for granted again. That is for sure. Well, the other reason, Jim, I was excited to have you come on the program today is to have you respond to this interview that I did with Jeffrey Korzenich, the author of Untapped Talent. And Jeffrey Korzenich, just to remind any listeners who didn't happen to hear that interview, is someone who has advocated for many, many years for businesses to hire the recently incarcerated. And really the point of this book is not so much to persuade people of sort of the ethical or moral reasons for doing so, but really more as kind of a practical guide to help a given company to do this well. Mm-hmm. And he kind of talks about different models by which this can be done. And he advocates for a certain way in which special supports are given to those who might be in this situation and trying to find their way into the workforce. I know, Jim, you listened to the interview, and I gave you a copy of the book to look at it a little bit. So, first of all, I'm just curious about kind of your initial impressions of what Mr. Korzenich has to say about all this.
I enjoyed his talk in this area. It's very pragmatic. I mean, you know, what's going on right now is that, and this has been happening all over the world for decades, U.S. business has not really been paying attention to it, and that's that our labor market has been shrinking. Everybody knows, is paying attention or listening to the kind of the narrative of our time, is that people are having less children. And that's not a new trend. That trend's been going on for a long time. And it preceded us in Europe. So Europe gave us the model for what was happening. I mean, even thinking about COVID, one of the issues of COVID in Italy was that the population is dramatically older than other European populations, so it hit them harder. They also have a smaller labor force because of that. I mean, there are just more people in their community that are out of the labor market, that are in the labor market. And you couple that with the demographic data that, you know, young people now are having less children. They're waiting longer, and they're having less children. And so he talks profoundly about, for example, in the United States, it takes about 2.5 million new workers a year just to stay level, just to replace jobs of people who retire and account for job growth. For the first time in U.S. history over the last couple of years, maybe 6 or 7 years, we've been under replacement. And Europe's been there for decades. And so Europe is bringing in people from other countries, you know, targeting engineers and doctors and lawyers from all over the world to come in and serve their population. But the U.S. has lagged behind. We've been kind of arrogant and not really paid attention to what's going on in the rest of the world. And so this kind of hit us like a ton of bricks, and COVID exacerbated it. A lot of people my age who are eligible to retire but love their work and keep working have rethought their being in the workplace. So a lot of those folks have left or not returned, which has made this problem pretty disastrous. The fallout of that is for reentrance, for people returning from prison, employers have not had to take that demographic seriously. They haven't needed them. So they've been able to operate fully without even considering. Those days are gone. They're completely gone. We're already seeing employers who are beginning to reach out to us who would have never reached out to us years ago. They can't get enough people to their door right now. Retirees are leaving sometimes earlier, taking a lot of skills with them. And so companies are going to be forced to begin to look beyond traditional markets for workers and traditional markets for training. They're going to have to do more in-house training, which they were doing when I started in the 70s and 80s. You know, companies had Gateway Technical College and campuses in all of their places learning pneumatics and, you know, fluid power and electronics and all the. And you could go right from your job and you could go to Gateway classes in your company. And all that went away when the market just flooded with people in the 90s. And so we're at a place now where employers, if they're smart, they'll pay attention to this demographic and figure out how to take advantage and how to shape their company policies of hiring, how to shape their training programs. As Korzenek makes a brilliant point, is that companies have been investing in employees for years and the billions of dollars of levels, but not this demographic. And so there's going to have to be a little refocusing on the kinds of training programs. And he points to nonprofits. I just wanted to stand up and cheer when he said that, that maybe this is time to collaborate with nonprofits who have expertise in this area to help folks not only maintain their positions, but to be in a position of moving up the chain and being promoted within their company.
Right. Explain to our listeners the role that Racine Vocational Ministries plays in this scenario. Explain exactly who you work with and the kind of things you try to accomplish with the people that are your, I guess, clients.
Yep. We call them participants. It was interesting listening to the parts of the discussion both online and in your program of, you know, what you call people who come back from prison. We've used some of those terms. You know, returning citizens and things like that. We call our folks participants. They're program participants. It's a little warmer than the word clients. And as you said, language matters. It really does play on different parts of our emotions. And labels can be really tough. And so we're quite careful. These are people just like us. You know, as he said and I've said, you know, nobody wants to be defined by the worst day of their life. And for most of
us, or their biggest mistake.
That's right. Most of us can get away with that. Some people cannot when it's public record and anybody can look it up. And so, the issue is, we are working with organizations like the Department of Corrections, and specifically they are segmenting even their own population due to kind of keeping an efficiency there of working with people who have the highest risk for going back to prison. There's a very good analysis tool that's been developed, and there are kind of children of that tool, where you're assessing the risks based on who they hang out with, the level of their antisocial thinking patterns, which is a real key that we focus on at RVM, the levels of criminality in the neighborhoods that they live in and the family systems that they belong to, and then traditional things like mental health and alcohol and drug issues, how those play in to the idea. But what we're paying most attention to is antisocial cognition, the way people think. A lot of organizations, much to their demise, really, are only focusing on barrier removal. If I can just get you a job, if I can just help you get a car, everything will be fine. Mm. Anybody who's had anybody in a family, for example, with mental health challenges, know that that's only part of the strategy, and it's actually part two, not part one. Mm. Part one is mental stability. It's if you need to be medicated, that needs to become consistent. If you need therapy, that needs to remain consistent. If it doesn't, family relationships are almost impossible to maintain well. And work relationships, in some ways, they're even harder to maintain than family relationships. You spend more time at your job than you probably do at home. And your supervisor and the management team around you probably has less investment in putting up with patterns that are destructive than your mother or father or brother and sister do. They're not as invested emotionally in you. And so the turnover rate for folks coming out of prison and going into jobs is catastrophic. I mean, because they're not ready to participate in a full pro-social activity. Hmm. And one of the ways I explain that to folks, it's a little crude, but it really makes the point. We've all had a time when we weren't sure how we're going to be able to make our car payment or make our rent. We're young and we're not making a whole lot of money and we're scratching our head going, what do I do? Most of us would, call mom or dad, even if that was hard, we'd call them, or a brother and sister who's a little more financially better off. If the opportunity's there, we might get a loan. But none of us ever thought of stealing a purse. Or holding up the corner liquor store. I can guess for most of our audience, that just never occurred to you to say, or I'll go back to mom and dad's house and I know where their cash drawer is and I'll just, nick a couple of $100 and I'll be okay. Those thoughts don't occur to pro-social thinking people. They just don't occur. That's not a pathway from a problem to a solution. That's wired into our brain through reinforcing. And so the opposite of that is also true. For some people, that's a default. I don't have a car. I'll just steal one. Mm. I mean, this happens in Milwaukee every day.
Right.
And it's epidemic. I don't have presents for my kids. I'm going to hang out in the mall parking lot. And when somebody comes out, I'll just steal their gifts. And then I got some stuff. Or I'll look at all the cars and see which one I can break into to steal from someone who's been shopping all day. That just doesn't occur to pro-social thinkers. And that's the easiest way I can kind of explain, and that runs all the way down to how you treat people in your relationships. Antisocial people tend to use people as resources and not really respect the relationship side of things. This isn't all 100% true. It's not true for everybody, and there are different levels, which is exactly what the Department of Corrections and RVM, through our assessments, are measuring. Mm. What's the level?
That reminds me of something Korzenek says in his book, which is that, and this is not based on anything scientific, but he kind of, his sense in studying this and looking at this is that, you can kind of break things down into thirds in terms of the current incarcerated population. About a third of them really can walk out of there and walk into a job and function very well, and others can do that with some help, and then there's maybe roughly a third where that is very likely not at all a possibility that antisocial behavior and attitude and thinking is so ingrained and so serious that they are just, you just can't even really think about that. So I'm guessing that you are mostly thinking about, in a sense, that middle third. Mm-hmm. Again, not that that really is scientifically mm-hmm. based, but we're talking about that middle third who potentially can be successful in the workplace, mm-hmm. but perhaps not without some interventions that you can provide. Is that a fair way to characterize it?
Yes, it's a fair way of how Mr. Krasenik presented it. And that struck me. It struck me very strongly. I would challenge his percentages.
Oh.
Very much so. I would say that we're closer to probably the people who come out of prison, one of those three demographics is the 10% who are job ready. They just come out and jump into a job. They've done the work they needed to do in prison, because prison programming, to the best efforts of corrections, is not meeting 100% of the population. You know, there's a small percent of the population that gets more resources based on opportunities, how long they're actually in that institution, don't have to be moved around. Mm. So there's some stability that can help some people get better programming. But I would say probably about 60 to 70% are in that middle group, that they're not going to succeed without a fair amount of help.
So rather than a third and a third and a third, it's more like a 10 and 70 and a 20.
Yes, and a 20, yes. And it's possible even that the percentage of people who just can't make it or won't make it is probably the smallest group. I might have, you know, I'm kind of talking off the top of my head here, but
sure. In
my experience, I see that there are very few people who can't make it. And some of that has to do with very simple things. It's like this demographic has a shocking number of head injuries due to bad family situations. Families don't pay attention. Kids fall downstairs. Gang fights and beatdowns. You know, other things they've been involved in. And so, you know, we find a lot of brain injury, a lot of cognitive issues where you can see that they really struggled in school, and they were probably learning disabled and not diagnosed. And so you have that demographic. But corrections itself looks at people who are just kind of the lost. They call them the high group of risk. It's probably about 3%.
Hmm.
And those folks, I mean, for every, you know, Charles Manson, there's hundreds of thousands of people who are nowhere near that area. And they're not physically damaged. They're not so mentally damaged that working with them in terms of medication therapy and traditional methods won't make a difference. They will make a difference. Mm-hmm. And so offering treatment options is very, very important for this demographic, because the more treatment options that are offered, the more people that are going to be able to make it in the workplace. Mm-hmm. So I'm much more hopeful. And this is it's funny that Krasenik said that. He said something like in your interview that you know, some nonprofits maybe have a little better handle on this, or they may be faith-based programs may have a little more hope and redemption.
Mm.
And we certainly do. You know, I mean, very simply, one of RVM's overlays is we believe that people were created and knit together in the womb by their creator, and not for criminality.
Mm.
And so it's a matter of coming back to your center, not necessarily changing who you are. It may be about changing your thought patterns and directing them in ways so that when you are out of money, you don't think of holding up the corner liquor store.
Right.
You know, you think of getting a job. You think of, what are my resources available to me? Am I going to go out and cut grass or shovel snow for a couple bucks to make this work until I can get more stable? Am I going to begin adopting a more pro-social narrative, which you and I just take completely for granted?
Right.
But a lot of folks have not had that option of taking it for granted.
So, at least in a nutshell, what are the tools or the means by which you try to help foster in some of these folks who have recently been in jail and mm-hmm. and very much want to enter the workforce and wider society and function with some normalcy and success? Mm-hmm. What are the tools that are most valuable, most significant in bringing that about?
There are two primary functions. I think I alluded to it already. And they really need to be done in this order, if possible. And the first order of business is what's referred to as cognitive behavioral therapy. And that's simply an opportunity to begin to reshape how a person views their world. People who come out of prison, especially if they've had multiple arrests and a lifetime of criminality, tend to look at life in a pretty dire way. Part of the fallout of living a life of criminality is, I'm a victim. I'm never going to get ahead. If I don't steal it or someone doesn't steal it for me, I'm never going to get it. This is how you get ahead in America, is by taking what you can get and letting the chips fall where they may. This attitude is so destructive and so undermining to community trust. Who would bring somebody like that into their circle except somebody who had a similar worldview? And so you start to get a kind of a myopic one view that everybody's this way.
Right.
And that's just simply not true. And so the one tool that we do is beginning this cognitive behavioral therapy process, looking at also the cost and the benefit of considering new criminal behavior and what the fallout of that might be. We find that part of criminal thinking is just a complete denial of the difficulties that can happen, or a complete reframing of the issue. I can do prison. I've done that before. No big deal. If I got to sit 2 years, it's worth the risk. And you begin to unpack that to literally create different cognitive pathways. Going back to prison becomes not an option.
Last thing they want to have happen.
That's right. Yeah. Because, that you begin to remind them, gee, when you were in prison, your father died and you couldn't attend the funeral. Your children had a problem. There was nobody to fund your family. As the Dragon Slayer, you felt your family was unprotected. While you're going, you remind them of all these thoughts that obsessed them while they were in, but that tend to go away when they come out. And so you really are beginning a process of thinking and looking at your world in a completely new way. That's community building, not community destroying. And where's your place in that? And I often say to people that we're marketing hope. We have to help people have a sense of they can get from here to there. And so that's one of the first places and first tools that we begin, is to help people have a sense of hope in the direction they're taking, and then to commit to a process of thinking about their world and their family and their relationships and their place in the world in a completely different way. That's number one. Once that begins to happen, a person becomes more likely to be successful in the workplace. And so once we start to get some real traction there, then we start looking at, okay, what do you aspire to? I can probably get you a job in a warehouse at $11 an hour with no benefits, and that's not going to help you very much. And it'll pay a few bills, and then you'll get bored with it. So, where's your field of fascination? Where do you want to work? If you want to work in a hospital, for example, you may not be ready to work as a CNA, and you may not even be legally able to do that. But if you are, having you be a landscaper at a hospital is an entry-level job. You're around it. You hear the lingo. You see people every day. You get an idea for how people in hospitals behave. What's their tone like? All Saints used to say to me all the time, we want people who are willing to greet people in the hallways. We want them to look up when they're walking through. People are in a tremendously anxious situations in hospitals. We want our staff to lessen that, to be helpful. Even if you're going to a meeting and you're late, if somebody can't find their surgical room or their doctor's office, take them to the office. It's more important. And so, that's in some ways very counterintuitive, especially if you have antisocial cognition. And so you begin to build these pieces little by little, and then their jobs tend to succeed. They also tend to want to hang on to them. For example, if they want to be, a radiologist, the first step for somebody extremely far away from that could be landscaping or housekeeping in a hospital. And then when they're in a hospital, maybe the hospital will pay some tuition reimbursement for skills that will benefit their company. So you find them ways to their fields of fascination rather than just simply placing them anywhere. And if it must be a survival job, say you're packing Kringles and you really want to be an electrical engineer, there may not be a lot of opportunities there, but then you can build school in, You begin to build in, even now with YouTube the way it is, you can learn an awful lot on YouTube and just start building information in so that when you do go to school, you have some framework for what you're getting into. So cognitive change is number one, cognitive interventions. And then number two is barrier removal. You need to remove barriers for, and that may be just advocating for somebody with a company and saying, hey, I've been working with this guy for a year and a half. He's had a pretty stable, you know, survival job, and he's ready to make the step to the next level.
That's important for us to know that your relationship with a given person does not end when they get that first job in a warehouse or McDonald's, wherever, but you are with them for more of the journey than probably a lot of us might assume, and that part of that journey is, in a sense, taking them up the ladder through into more and more satisfying positions.
Mm-hmm. It's high-level relationship building. I mean, one of the things, again, that our all of our data tells us is that the more significant pro-social relationships that people with antisocial cognition have, the faster the change happens. And so we become, in some ways, some of the first people who have really strong pro-social centers, and then we help them build out from there. You know, are there people at their church, or can they go back to their childhood church and begin to connect and find people who are working every day, who, you know, are doing a great job of raising their kids, who will invite them over for Thanksgiving, you know, for a meal, and go to see a movie with them and things like that. You want those relationships to begin to build and become more significant. And then they'll behave in the community better. They'll function in a workplace better. Their social skills will go up. Their language skills will go up, which is also a real barrier. When you come off the street and out of prison, there's a kind of a unique inside language that's used in prison. And if that's been your life, you know, that language does not work in an interview. Your interviewer will have no idea what you're talking. It's like code. You know, words don't mean the same thing on the outside as they do on the inside. And so, you know, you have to help them with, you know, community acceptable language. We call it corporate English. You got to be able to interview with corporate English. And what does that mean? It means a lot of practice. It means training yourself to stay in that kind of corporate English mode for the whole time that you're there. You know, good quality handshakes, good quality eye contact, all those, you know, a good posture, you know, that part of, you know, the street, the street shaping is that it's important that you don't look like you care about anything. You know, you got to sit and you slouch and, you know, you look at your fingernails and you don't make a lot of strong eye contact and a lot of 2 and 3 word grunts and answers to things. And that just doesn't work. It doesn't engender any trust from the employer that you're going to be a real part of their system. And so they're watching for those kinds of body signals and language signals that go, does this guy fit or not? So we got to coach them through that, and we have to help them understand that, you know, whatever they did on the streets probably not going to work here.
Roughly right now, how many people are you working with, Racine Vocational Ministries, roughly?
In the reentry program, our consistent population is just under 100, 80, 90. And in the walk-in program, where there's no prerequisite for any kind of criminal background, although 30% of our walk-in population also has some significant criminal barriers, we see about 170 or 180. So we're usually somewhere between 250 and 300 people a year that we're running through our program.
And as you said, in this current climate, you're actually seeing much more interest from businesses out in the community for what you do. And I mean, in a sense, that's a sad, I mean, even scary situation. And yet that has to be gratifying that there are even more opportunities, more doors potentially can be open for the people you're trying to serve.
This is a window. I don't know how long it's going to last. We had a window maybe about 10 years ago, and it lasted about 6 months. It was pretty brief. But I think this is going to go for a while. I think we're going to have job shortages. I mean, more and more people, you keep reading articles in the Wall Street Journal and Newsweek and everywhere you're reading about our economy, that more and more people are opting out of the job market.
Right.
More people are opting not to come back.
Right.
You know, they don't want to work in an office anymore. They would rather retire than go back to the office. And people are reevaluating. Some people who had health issues coming out of COVID and said, you know what, I want to travel a little bit. I'm not going back to work. And so there's a lot of openings nationwide.
Right. And this is an opportunity for Racine Vocational Ministries to do even more good on behalf participants. Jim Schatzman is its director. We direct you to their website for more information about all of the good things that Racine Vocational Ministries is doing and the ways in which you can support them. Jim Schatzman, I thank you so much for being here, and we wish you well. And also, we wish all the members of the Choral Arts Society.